Welcome to the PrevMed Health Podcast with Dr. Brewer, your go-to source for heart attack and stroke prevention. And I am your host, Ford Brewer. Each week, we dive deep into the latest trends, expert insights, and practical tips to help you decrease your risk of heart attack and stroke. We discuss plaque reversal, insulin resistance, prediabetes, diabetes, cholesterol, supplements, medications, and so much more. So sit back, relax, and have this journey to a long and healthy life together.
Welcome. Today we're going to talk about vitamin D3. Let me just give you a couple of facts. The standards committees for vitamin D3, the experts, the global experts that have studied this, recommend 2,000 international units a day, no more than 4,000 in special cases. On the other hand, there was recently a very popular video. Eric Berg interviewed a fellow named Bruce Hollis, and some quotes that were taken away from that were Bruce saying, you know, 50,000 international units a day is not that bad, or something like that. Maybe something like you can take 50,000 international units. Now, vitamin D3 comes from, has a long, long story, and we're going to get a lot of haters just because we're going to take a position. Now, the position that we take, you might not like, but at the end of the day, if you care about your health, and if you care about vitamin D3, you probably need to take a little bit deeper dive than just trying to hit on one of these numbers or the other. We're going to start today. When I first started investigating the science, the evidence behind vitamin D3, one of the things that I found was a common common thread of deaths associated with having vitamin D3 at higher serum levels. So after looking at it, I came up with a basic standard recommendation of 5,000 international units because I never saw significant problems with that in the evidence. And then getting a serum level. Jesus is going to tell you a story today about one of those patients that I saw as I reviewed the literature that had significant problems at higher doses. Jesus, you want to get started?
Absolutely. And let me see if my connection cooperates. We have a really interesting story for you guys today. So this is the story of Mr. Singh. Mr. Singh is 65 years old, is retired. He's usually an active folk with no other major prominent health issues that you might think. He used to have some aches and pains here and there. They started showing up mostly on the back of his legs, nothing unusual. And the one thing is that instead of going to the doctor, you might know the challenges behind going to the doctor and then getting not necessarily the response that you're looking for. He went there, instead of going there, he started researching online. And he figured out that some of the stuff that is out there online was suggesting that he was having a problem with maybe some weak bones and osteoporosis and recommended to start using some vitamin D, right? So he started finding some evidence suggesting that vitamin D3 could help with that. And he started including that into his protocol. He actually found a way to get not only the pill, he went a little bit more extreme because he found out that if you take the pill, sometimes that doesn't get absorbed as well. And he saw some injections that could be an option for him. So that sounded good. That sounded something that he could do. And he got his hands on vitamin D injections. These injections, each and every one of them had 50,000 international units. So the idea was to inject himself with those 50,000 international units once a week. And he was originally supposed to be injecting with him with those things for no more than 6 weeks. So that was six injections. But the thing that happened is that he started to feel so good about it. His aches and pains starting to minimize. He was feeling better that he decided just to keep on doing it. And he kept injecting 50,000 units every week for, you guess it, you can guess it. It wasn't 1 month. He didn't keep doing that for 2 months or 3 months. He actually kept doing that for about 1 year. So 12 months of injecting himself with 50,000 units of vitamin D3. So everything was well and good until he started to notice that he was losing his appetite. He started developing some nausea, and that thing didn't go away. He even tried maybe some antacids and some other stuff that could help with that. Really didn't help. Actually, he started getting worse. He started vomiting again and again. He started feeling more weak. He started to feel exhausted, even after having a complete night of sleep. He was too tired to walk. He was too tired to even talk or even think clearly. And then things started to get worse. So he was not eating properly. He was very tired and weak. But he started to get confused to the point where he was starting to forget names, to the point where he started to ask multiple questions to the same person multiple times. And of course, the family was starting to get worried because this wasn't Mr. Singh anymore. Something was going on. So what they did was that at this point, his family started to intervene and said, okay, there's something going on here. We're going to go to the ER because this could be a stroke. This could be dementia. This could be something that we don't know. So he went to the ER. They started to run some tests. They tried to get as much of a complete history that they could. And they noticed a couple of things. Like one of the major issues they noticed is his kidney function. His kidney function, whenever you have a creatinine level of over 1, that's something that you may say, okay, this is something that is not gonna, this is something that is not normal. His was 5.1. So if you have a creatinine of 5.1, that means, hey, just your kidneys are shutting down. And that's what happening. The diagnosis was acute kidney injury. So on the panel they run, we usually run a wide panel depending on what you're suspecting is happening. So when there's somebody who's dealing with issues with memory, with acute onset of confusion, you want to know if this is metabolic, this is neurological, and you run studies for a bunch of things, including biochemistry labs. And in this one, they noticed that there was one specific marker that was very elevated, and this was calcium. His calcium levels was something close to 14.4 milligrams per deciliter, which is very, very high. So what happens when you have that amount of calcium in your bloodstream? Yes, your kidneys might show down, but also you can get heart rhythm issues that can lead to a sudden cardiac arrest. So this was very, very worrying. And when they really find out, and after asking multiple times and getting the accurate history, they noticed and they realized that Mr. Singh was injecting himself vitamin D 50,000 units every week. So they said, well, okay, let's measure it. And they measured the inactive form 25-hydroxy. And the reason we measured the inactive form is because based on the evidence, it's the one that has been most closely correlated with the real vitamin D status level, not the active form, because that gets used. It's the inactive form that really correlates with whatever issue you might have, including positive or negative. His level was 218 nanograms per deciliter. We're going to have a discussion about what's a normal, what's a healthy level versus what isn't. So at this point, unfortunately,
Go ahead. You had a tech problem. So you said we're basically going to look a little bit deeper at the facts around this case and the facts around this issue.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, I just needed to interrupt to go ahead. I just needed to clarify what you were saying.
And I appreciate that because, as I mentioned, my connection is not cooperating today. So they noticed that was what happening. So they noticed that the vomiting, the fatigue, the confusion, the acute kidney injury, the kidney damage was coming from the vitamin D supplementation. I don't want you to try to translate this information into say, oh, vitamin D is toxic and nobody should take vitamin D. We're just trying to say, hey, if you think that there are no cases of vitamin D toxicity, they are. Actually, this is not a story that I'm making up. This is a case report that we're putting the link on the description for you to read. Fortunately, yeah. After they noticed this was what's happening with his kidney function, he got treatment for it. He got fluids. They stopped the vitamin D. They treat the high calcium levels, and over time, that started to improve. I think this is a good moment to discuss what happened, why vitamin D can be toxic, what happened to Mr. Singh that caused him the kidney damage. Because actually, if you know a little bit about vitamin D, you will hear that vitamin D elevates calcium and calcium levels cause kidney stones. And Mr. Singh didn't have any kidney stones, and yet he developed kidney injury. And I think that's an interesting point to discuss. Dr. Brewer, want to throw a question, a comment before we go into the geeky part of vitamin D?
Well, I'll go into a couple of things. Number one, I was a little bit more conservative at the time. I met a doctor once who was into functional medicine and prevention, and he had lost his license over this issue. He had recommended a patient to take vitamin D3. He didn't tell me exactly which dosages he was recommending. He did say that the patient took more than he suggested. The patient did have kidney failure and ended up losing function of her kidneys, and he died, and he lost his license as a result of litigation. I've also seen two patients that came to me with blood levels. One of them was like 115. The other one was like 125. And with both of them, they were doing something similar to what the case that you're describing did. And in fact, it's one of the more common ways of seeing what I would have called hypervitaminosis D3 or vitamin D3 toxicity. One of those patients, the one at a blood level of 125, had significant kidney damage. We took her off of the vitamin D3. And over the next few weeks, her kidney function improved. So, again, when you look at the literature, you look at my own experience, you see a lot of cases where folks are taking these 25,000, 50,000 international unit dosages, which were often meant to be given once a week. Both of the patients that I saw with these high levels, same scenario. They were seeing a functional or naturopath or preventive medicine doctor and were taking these high doses. They had been prescribed once a week, but they were taking them daily. So again, you can see my perspective, and you can probably imagine my reaction when I started hearing Eric and Dr. Hollis. So I decided to start a few of the things that Eric said about Dr. Hollis's background made me go a little bit deeper and want to check. And I'll talk a little bit more about Dr. Hollis's comment and his background, where he's coming from, when you're ready. But I think you wanted to get to some other stuff first. Is that right?
Correct. And I think there are a couple of items that we really need to address. I'm starting to see those on the comments because there are a couple of things where we do agree with Dr. Berg and Dr. Hollis. Like, is this case something that's going to happen to most people? No, that's the truth. Mm-hmm. It's rare. Fortunately, it's rare. Is the juice worth the squeeze to try to put your levels of vitamin D close to 200 to get certain benefits? I think that for the average person, maybe not. There are some research, especially in Brazil, Dr. Coimbra has a protocol where he uses very high doses of vitamin D for multiple sclerosis and other autoimmune diseases. There's also some description for cancer. And my position is that if you have a situation or a disease that has no cure, and you try to use something more extreme like this, of course you want to do it with the help of, with a physician that it's used to using those doses, knowing the risks behind it. The other point that we acknowledge is that not everybody develops kidney stones. All of that is true. The problem is, what's your specific case? Because to us, the big benefit comes when you reach levels between 50 and 90, or maybe 100, and that's it. Is there a higher risk for toxicity if you have maybe 110, maybe 120? Maybe not. But it also depends on your specific situation. There are things that I have heard Dr. Berg said that we don't necessarily agree 100%. One is, if you take magnesium, enough magnesium, vitamin D toxicity will not happen. If you take enough vitamin K2, it will not happen. And to me, that's partially correct. If you look at the metabolism of vitamin D3 will help you absorb calcium from the gut. And it helps moving around between the bones, the bloodstream, and to different places where it should go. Magnesium is a cofactor, meaning that it helps transform active vitamin D3 into inactive vitamin D3, and it helps minimizes the damage that you can get from high active vitamin D3. So the key word is helps. Will that, is it true that if you have normal magnesium levels, you're not gonna have vitamin D toxicity if you're taking 50,000 units a day? I think that's a stretch. I haven't seen evidence that is measuring specifically that situation. Might minimize the risk? Probably. If you're taking vitamin K2, because vitamin K2 moves calcium from the bloodstream into the bones, will that minimize the risk of you developing high calcium level? I don't think that's going to happen. I think it helps. Again, helps. But I don't think that if you're taking such big doses of vitamin D3 without monitoring your levels, you just say, oh, okay, I can take 20,000 international units of vitamin D3 every day. And since I'm taking magnesium and vitamin K2, I'm fine. I don't even have to measure my blood levels. I think that's the problem. If you want to take high doses, just make sure your levels are fine, that you're not developing any kind of injury. And I don't think that's going to be a problem. Now, the question is, why are you taking those high doses? What's your goal? What's your health objective for you to decide to take very high doses of vitamin D3? Because you might not need that much. I think that's our whole speech for this show, isn't it?
Well, yeah, you let the cat out of the bag too soon.
Maybe I did. I apologize, Dr. Brewer.
That's okay. You do that all the time. Then you accuse me of doing it.
Well, it is okay when I do it. It is wrong when you do it.
You're ready for me to talk about Dr. Hollis and his background?
Yes. Go ahead.
So, again, if you saw the interview with him and Eric, Dr. Bruce Hollis said something like, I think he made one comment that he personally takes 50,000 units of vitamin 3 per day. I don't know that he does that every day and how long he's been doing it. And he also said something like, it's not necessarily that dangerous. So if you're thinking this guy, Dr. Hollis is extreme, some crazy internet quote expert, end quote, think again, take a closer look. Dr. Hollis is a real expert in vitamin D3. He's one of the world's top researchers in D3 metabolism. Career spanning more than four decades in this space. He earned a PhD in nutritional biochemistry from the University of Guelph in Canada in 79, completed his BS and MS at Ohio State, here in the U.S. He's a tenured professor at my old alma mater, Medical University of South Carolina. He serves as the director of the Pediatric Nutritional Sciences group. What really sets him apart, though, is the scope of his research. He's developed some of the first FDA-approved assays or measurements, lab tests, to measure for 25-hydroxy vitamin D. And 125 dihydroxy vitamin D as well. The the major circulating forms of vitamin D3 in the body. So again, he's got a lot of background. His work didn't stop in the lab either. He's run major clinical trials looking at vitamin D supplementation during pregnancy, lactation, and infancy. And his recommendations to go up to maybe 4,000, even 6,400 international units per day, especially for pregnant women, showed that they weren't just tolerated, but they were safe and effective. Those recommendations, by the way, were some of the recommendations that led to my own of 5,000 international units per day. His research showed that these higher doses improved both maternal and infant vitamin D levels. So, in fact, his research has helped push the field towards understanding what levels of vitamin D are actually needed for immune function, not just bone health. And let me go back and do a quick nod to the history about bone health. Vitamin D was originally discovered as a vitamin that improved rickets. Rickets is where, if you don't see it in the modern world, but you'd have to go back and look at some pictures. People with extreme bow-leggedness, bone deformities, sickle shins, I mean, just massive, awful, dysfunctional, debilitating curves in the bones of their legs. And it was discovered that this vitamin would stop that disease. So for the longest time, that was what that vitamin was about. But more modern research, and this started maybe 20 to 30 years ago, people started looking at this vitamin and saying, maybe this is for more than just rickets and bone health. And sure enough, evidence has piled up that it has a lot to do with mental health, depression, anxiety. It's a major issue in terms of metabolic health, metabolic disease, prevention of diabetes. And so if it's important there, then it is critical to what we know as, quote, normal aging and debilitation, heart attacks and strokes even. So when you look in our practice internally, the two top supplements that we use are niacin for some lipidology and carbohydrate metabolic reasons, and vitamin D3. And vitamin D3 for the metabolic health reasons that we just discussed. So back to Dr. Hollis. His work has appeared in leading journals like the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism, Pediatrics, big, big journal. The American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, all very big journals, very, very well respected. He's also one of the few researchers with an active investigational new drug license from the FDA for high-dose vitamin D studies. It means he's legally authorized to conduct human trials at doses far above the current recommended daily allowances of vitamin D. So, at the end of the day, when he says something bold like vitamin D toxicity is extremely rare, or most people are severely underdosed on vitamin D, he's not talking theory. He's talking what he's seeing in terms of his own research and the other research that's out there. Talking from clinical data, lab analysis, decades of research. So now, let's go back. And here, again, I think is one of the issues where I think we need to step back and how do you put all this together? You've got International Standards Committee saying 2,000 international units. You've got the, Dr. Hollis with this kind of background saying up to 50. You know, well, what's a mother to do? I mean, how are we going to figure this out? And again, I think a lot of the problem is we all want to put things in a soundbite. It's a soundbite kind of social media world. But the real world is not so much sound bites. It gets a little bit more complicated than that. Jesus will tell you, you know, it, and you've heard him say it. He gets so frustrated when he or somebody else would ask me a question, and it was like, well, that depends. And unfortunately, if you want the real story, sometimes it's a little bit more complicated than a sound bite. So you need context, you need lab testing, you need proper monitoring. All of those are important when you look deeper at the vitamin D story. Yep. What does it mean that we should take conversation more seriously, especially when mainstream guidelines still lag behind in the research? So, as Jesus said, I think when you look at what we're doing, what my perspective is on vitamin D3, it's, yeah, I think there's plenty of evidence that that higher doses than the 2,000 international units do make sense. When you go to make one more nod back to the more recent history of vitamin D3, I stopped with 30 and 40 years ago discussions where they started to find that it's helpful with sleep, it's helpful with metabolism, it's helpful with mental health. But I didn't go 3 and 4 years ago, back to COVID-19. It was very, very interesting that when COVID hit, you started seeing and hearing experts from Harvard, from Mayo, from other big dispensers of standard medicine saying, you know what? We started looking at vitamin D levels, and populations with vitamin D levels in the higher ranges were protected from cytokine storm, from death and major disability associated with COVID. So again, there's a little bit more to the story here than just trying to take one sound bite and running with it and arguing with anybody that decides to take the sound bite at the other extreme. So again, I'm going to go back to Jesus's comment and say, so I think that we're not looking at either extreme. I think what we're looking at is risks versus benefits. I think from my perspective, yes, there's clearly risks in the 150 to 200 range. There's no question. You start looking these up. And as Bruce has said, I think he's right. It's given the number of people that are taking vitamin D3, it's not that common for people to have injuries. But let's go back and look at similar situations. You know, a whole lot of people smoke cigarettes all their life and don't have lung cancer and don't die from it. But yet there's enough to where it's probably not a good idea to smoke cigarettes. A whole lot of people text and drive and don't have a wreck. But there's enough people that do have wrecks and die that it's becoming more and more illegal in more and more states. More and more governments are saying, look, this is just too dangerous. Don't do it. So I go back and I look, and that's where my own recommendations have come from. There's clearly enough evidence to say you probably want it over 40, maybe something closer to 50, between 50 and 90. But once you start getting it over 100, it may be safe for most people. The question is, again, risk versus benefit. Is it safe for everybody? No, that's clear. You know, even Bruce had said that, no, that's, you know, you got challenges in terms of magnesium and certain metabolisms. And the other question is, what benefit are you getting at that vitamin D3 level between 100 and 200?
That was a fantastic essay.
Well, thank you. I don't expect that. That's uncommon coming from you.
Well, there's one thing that people sometimes forget. And you and I don't agree 100% with anybody, not even with each other.
Especially with each other.
But I do agree when you say it depends, even if I hate it, because I used to push you into take a stance. And that's the stance. It really depends on each and every one individual. I want to go to a couple of comments that I'm seeing here in the chat. One of them is, we haven't even said that yet. Vitamin D3 behaves like a hormone. That's why you see prescriptions of 50,000 units a week, which is actually, for most people, it's kind of a safe approach, yeah, if you don't do it for a year, of course, because vitamin D3 is going to go into your fat cells. It's going to get stored in there, and it's going to be released as necessary. That's why it behaves like a hormone. It it acts in some other places while it's being stored on the fat cells. So that's one I wanted to mention. Is it the same vitamin D3 that you get from sunlight than what you get from a vitamin or from vitamins basically? It's not necessarily the same because there are mechanisms established where if you get too much exposure to the sunlight, some of that excess vitamin D3 that gets produced on your skin is going to get metabolized and transformed into other inactive compounds as a safety mechanism. The body itself does that. That's why you see people that might live in southern Florida and still have low levels of vitamin D3. So it's not just sun exposure. And actually, some people challenge that. But I don't know, what's your perspective on skin cancer? Do you think that UV exposure to sunlight can increase your risk of cancer?
Oh, I think it can. Yeah,
I think so too. There are people that say that you can expose yourself to sun as many times as you want, as much time as you want. I don't think that's necessarily safe. But again, it goes back to your own genetics, just like you said with the example on the cigarettes.
Exactly. Where else to go? I think some people can just. My father, for example, used to do that all the time. My mother and I. And some other folks in my family, I've had over 4 dozen skin cancers.
Yep.
And it's so we basically had the same kinds of exposure that my father had. And it's just like, it depends. It depends on what your genetics are.
Yet again. And then you come to the part of the conversation on, so does everybody need vitamin D3 supplementation? Maybe, just because this is on the evidence. This is not something somebody said. Most people have some level of deficiency on vitamin D3 and magnesium, both. Yeah. And for the standards, vitamin D3 deficiency starts at 30 nanograms or less, which is severe. Yeah. So you might go to the lab and they will say, oh, you have 45, 40, that's okay. And to us, the optimal, not normal level, optimal level should be at least 50. But we try not to get over 100 anytime. Not because 100 is necessarily dangerous. It's just because you're getting closer to the danger level. And it's not necessarily providing even more benefits.
Well, as I said, I saw temporary kidney damage in one of those patients at 125.
Yeah, and you can reverse that. You can reverse that by stopping
the vitamin D3. And we did. We stopped her vitamin D3. Her levels started coming down, and in a few weeks, her kidney function improved too.
Yeah, and we didn't discuss that. Now that you touch on kidney disease, kidney function, we usually say, okay, so vitamin D3, high calcium, kidney damage because of that, right? Because of kidney stones. But it's not always kidney stones. High calcium levels can also cause that the artery that goes to the kidneys shrinks, like does like this. This is my broken finger. So let me try with this hand. So it doesn't look good. It does like this. So the blood flow into the kidney reduces, and lower blood flow or less blood flow into the kidney causes kidney injury, which is very probably what happened to Mr. Singh on the case we presented today. The other point is you can get accumulation of calcium within the walls of the kidney vessels as well, which leads also to kidney calcification. It's not necessarily kidney stones, but also damages the inner layer of the artery wall and the kidneys, causing that issue as well. And that's long-term. That doesn't happen one day to the other. That's exactly what happened to Mr. Singh, very likely, where he was 1 year away. And that's when he started developing issues. And also developing issues on brain function as well, because of those high levels of calcium. When you have kidney damage as well, if your creatinine levels go up, you start accumulating another substance called urea. And urea can cross the blood-brain barrier and cause confusion and damage. That's what we call a type of delirium caused by kidney injury. You get an accumulation of urea in your brain and you can't think right. Urea is what gives the smell to the urine. So imagine that. It's like having a portion of urine in your brain, if you want to see it that way. So that's terrible. Like, I'd rather just drop dead than develop severe kidney disease. That's horrible.
So anything else from you or me on vitamin D?
I'm here spilling my guts out, and Jersey was like, I hope when is he going to stop talking so we can go to the next topic? Can you just tell the audience if I'm right or wrong? Because they will listen to you.
Oh, yeah. And they'll listen to you, too. And well, you're right. This is a deeper metabolic issue than a lot of people think about. They just think, well, it's a supplement. Do I take it? And how much do I take? I get all that, but, you know, it's, again, like we said, sometimes reality is a little bit more complicated. And as you said, yeah, you can get squeezing and loss of blood supply to those kidneys. That's one of the things that can drive some of the kidney damage. You mentioned hormone. You know, most people call it a hormone. It's technically called a prohormone. From my perspective, I don't even know what a prohormone is. It acts as a hormone in the body.
Yeah, it behaves like a hormone. Yeah. Yeah. It's not classified like, I mean, it's not like you need a prescription for it. If it was behaved like, if it was labeled like strictly as a hormone, you will probably need a prescription for it, which is not the case. And just so people understand, because we have a short that is very popular where you say, hey, don't take vitamin D3 and K2 together. And they kind of took it the wrong way. And they say, oh, Dr. Brewer is against vitamin D3. We're not saying that. We're just saying most presentation of vitamin D3 and K2 don't have enough K2. And that's the point we're trying to make. As a matter of fact, I do take vitamin D every day, 5,000 units, because my levels were low. And that's what you're trying to do. Just test, don't guess, and try to take the right amounts. Gilbert, why don't we go to the Q&A and get ready to do that? Why don't you try, Gilbert, do you know, instead of the water ball, which cost Dr. Brewer $30, we had another transition that cost us like basically free. We made it for free. Can you try that, Gilbert? The R3 one? It's a little bit too short, isn't it?
It is, but it makes the point.
Then they changed the noise. The noise it was crumbling. This was more like AMSDR, where people are moving their lips on the microphone. That's really weird.
Anyhow, we need to get a little bit slicker on how we use that, but it gets the point across. And I think that and the water ball both are great.
Yeah, I think it went too fast. We're going to work on that. Okay, let's go ahead and answer some questions.
Anyhow, bottom line, that transition meant we're getting ready to go into Q&A.
Yeah, we might go back to the water bowl probably. Okay, want to read the question?
Woody Woodring, doctors, good day. Have you done a video stating how long it takes to get A1C below 5.0 on a very low keto diet? I'm eating less than 20 carbs per day for the past 3 months. Will I see a change? You should have already seen a change, Woody. One of the things that slows it down is what kind of size your liver was before you started. You know, a typical liver is what, 5 pounds? A little bit less. And somebody with a whole lot of glycogen can have twice that or more in their liver. Well, glycogen is just nothing but a stored sugar. In the muscles, it's one thing. It's not going to get out so much and impact A1C, but and usually liver glycogen won't either, but it can. That appears to be the most common reason for that. So there are people that it takes months to start getting to the end of glycogen in their liver.
Yeah. And I will add that exercise is tremendously important.
Tremendously. Big deal.
I can give you an example. You know this story. I was off playing soccer for a while because of an ankle injury. And the day I decided to go back to a game, I was wearing a CGM. And even though I'm a goalkeeper, it's not like I run too much on the field. I do had a lot of quick responses to the ball and all that stuff, right? So I went to play like at 8 a.m. in the morning. I had nothing for breakfast. I was fasted for like 12 hours at that point. And after looking at my CGM, my glucose went up to 180. So some of that might be maybe the movement or whatever, but it was a clear spike. And my guess is it's mostly glycogen that you yep. still have stored. So there are two points in there to consider. Even if you're in a very low carb-restricted keto diet, you can still develop or create more glycogen just because of your own genetics and your own metabolism. The body will try to create glucose and will try to have some reserves for glycogen, and it will do it from muscle. And how you stop that? By exercising, by building your own muscle. So your muscle is used to, your protein is used to create muscle, and the protein is not used to create glycogen. Do you agree with that statement, Dr. Brewer?
Oh, yeah. No question. And that's a really, really good point. If you're dropping your dietary carbs and want to lower your A1C, at some point you got to get out there and start exercising.
Exactly right. All right.
You also demonstrated that when you did your when you overdid your first water fast.
Oh yeah, and the other point was my goal right now, my journey is, I think my diet's pretty clean right now. My journey is to increase muscle mass, and I'm working towards that. And I can tell you for a fact, Dr. Bro and I spent the last week together. He works a lot. It seems like it doesn't, but he does work a lot. And I think that's a major portion of having that progress. I didn't say good morning. Good morning, D3 Oliver. Thank you so much for being a member. So if you want to be a member, we're going to be answering your questions first. Just click. I think YouTube changed it to now it's like subscribe plus. It has a plus icon in there. So you click in there, and now you become a member of the channel. That your help goes a long way, just so you know. Okay, Dr. B, can you explain what happens to your blood sugar when you have a hypoglycemic event? I did an OGTT, then had a sugar crash, and had to go to the hospital. Nobody ever explained what actually happened.
Well, not sure exactly. Jesus, I'll stumble around with this a little bit, and maybe you can figure out what the specific question is about and some good stuff to add. Bottom line is, most of us get used to blood sugar levels. When we're young and healthy, we probably get blood sugar has what we call a diurnal pattern. It's highest for most of us in the afternoon and lowest for most of us between 2 and 4 in the morning. One of the things that you'll start seeing when you start dropping your carbs, your glycemic carbs, and wearing a CGM is that your blood sugars at between midnight and 4 in the morning do get lower. Now, I remember I had hypoglycemic events when I first started on my low-carb journey. I also overdid it. I did like a Jesus. I pushed too hard, got overly confident. I'd been doing low-carb for a few weeks, and I thought I was fine. I went ahead and added metformin. And what happened was I went out on a long bike ride up a lot of hills. So, you know, you're cranking a bike up hills. Your biggest muscles in your body, your calves, your thighs, your hips are really pushing hard and burning. I got hypoglycemic. And the other time that I got hypoglycemic or low blood sugar was just waking up one morning. And in both times, I did check my blood sugar, and it was really in the 60s. So a couple of things to think about. A lot of people don't have problems in the 60s. When you look at me 6 months later and since then, I have had many times when I'd get into the 50s and I felt fine. So there's another thing that goes on here too, and that's the body's ability to adapt. So I go back to one of my earlier comments. When you're young and maybe a teenager, you're in good health, managing your glucose very well. Quite often, I expect you're getting into your 50s between midnight and 4 a.m. A lot of young, very healthy people will have morning glucose levels below 90 in the 80s. Again, as we start getting older and we get into that Gary Taubes part of life where he says, you know, why we get fat in his book, Why We Get Fat and What to Do About It and Good Calories, Bad Calories. We think we're getting fat because we're eating more. And that's not really what's going on. We're eating more because we can't burn our fuels. And the reason we can't burn our fuels is we're getting resistant to insulin. So therefore, the sugar that is that's in our blood, our insulin receptors can't pull it into our cells where we can burn it. So we increase our insulin. That's how our body overcomes insulin resistance. Well, increased insulin causes a problem with burning fats. So especially when you start going from this, what we call burning hot, where your body has this, is more used to 90 to 150 kind of levels. And then you start dropping your carbs and you start getting back down to those lower levels. You can start running into some times when you're feeling like, hey, man, I can't burn my carbs. I can't burn my fats. And you bonk. Bonk is a technical term. It's a sports term. I used to be a marathon runner, and bonking is you just run out of gas. So hopefully I've given you time, Jesus, to come back and clean up.
That was quite an essay. You were prepared today to really explain yourself, and people love that. I've heard those stories so many times now that I actually know what you're going to say next at this point. But it's great. My perspective was a little bit different, though. I wanted to go back to the conversations from Dr. Bickman about oral glucose tolerance test behavior on somebody who's doing low-carb diet, somebody who's not eating enough carbohydrates. And they say, if you're on a carnivore, low-carb diet, keto diet, and you go ahead and do the oral glucose tolerance test where you get that fluid and you drink the 75 grams of sugar, and then you test your blood sugar and your insulin levels, you can expect your blood sugar levels to go really high and have and maybe a misdiagnosis or diabetes or pre-diabetes because you're not producing enough insulin because you're on a low-carb diet. If you're on a low-carb diet, you don't produce that much insulin. So your body is, quote-unquote, unprepared to manage that amount of glucose. That's kind of my interpretation of what they say. Maybe I'm wrong. I'll be happy to be called out on that.
That's a common belief.
But the example of Woody right here, he's on a low-carb diet, and yet he developed a hypoglycemia, low blood sugar levels, after the oral glucose tolerance test. Then that in our perspective, what we see happening in there is an overreaction to your insulin.
So that's what he was talking about. You're right.
You drink the blood sugar, your insulin starts to spike, but the response you get from that insulin is just too hard. So when the blood sugar is going up, it starts putting it back down like too low, at a very low level. It's like you injected yourself with a higher dose of insulin that you needed. What happens with people with type 1 diabetes when they're trying to titrate their doses, they're not sure how much they need. You might get that, and you can get into what they call an insulinemic shock, or I think that's the way you call it. You in the U.S., you call it that way, right? Insulin shock?
Yeah, you can call it that. You know, one of the things that you used to hear from doctors and patients 30, 40 years ago was reactive hypoglycemia.
Yeah.
And then when they started getting rid of the OGTT and docs really began to lose touch with what's going on with the pancreas and blood sugar levels, they started saying that's a wives' tale. No, it's not a wives' tale. If you do a lot of OGTTs, you see very clearly reactive hypoglycemia is very, very common. One of the more common things that you see in early diabetes or pre-diabetes.
Yeah. And just last week, we had a very interesting conversation that how when Dr. Kraft, the doctor who invented the Kraft insulin survey, and the definition of oral glucose tolerance test, for many people, oral glucose tolerance test has to do with the insulin response to the glucose you drink. And we were conversating about, it's actually in Dr. Brewer's perspective, and I share that opinion, you need to measure both. You need to measure both glucose yeah. and insulin so you have a clear perspective. So without the numbers, it's hard to really say what happened. But in our experience, low blood sugar levels after the oral glucose tolerance test, it's usually a reflection still of insulin resistance when you're having to push too much insulin to the point that it's over effective, if you want to see it call it that way. It misses the capacity to really titrate your blood sugars to a normal level. JoSXM just had my second entry from Carotid Care with Arianna Feldberg. It's Feldberg. Feldman is our friend from Cholesterol Code, Dave. Nice woman. If you're in, is that Connecticut, Massachusetts?
Yeah.
Well, we're going to have results next week. Yeah.
Great. She is good. Very good. Nice lady and very good at what she does.
Thomas Handeside. I was taking 5,000 to 7,500, I believe it's units of vitamin D3. My latest blood test was above the test range. Shut down supplementation for at least a couple of months. What do you think? Do you need to stop? I mean, it depends on the level, I guess.
Yeah.
It's out of range, but how far?
Yeah, well, that's what I do. I'll get blood levels, and then if somebody's getting over 100, I start. Usually we get kidney function as part of our standard testing anyway, but especially if somebody comes to us and they've got those blood levels above 100, we start looking to monitor that. The patient that had some kidney damage, like we said before, did the same thing that he did, stopped the D3, and their kidney function returned.
Yep. This is an interesting question. Eduardo Peña, Nato or Nato-B? 61 years old, extensive plaque on Widowmaker. Soft, well, clear, blood pressure 105 or 62, CD, metformin, aspirin. Would supplementing natokinase help with plaque? How many fibrin units should it be? Thank you. I think that's a great question regarding natokinase. Do you have any opinions on natokinase? I know you do.
I do, but I'm stuck on this natto or natto-B. Is that like a reference?
That's a joke. Yeah, using natto. That's fun. It's funny.
You should have said natto or not natto-B. I don't know.
Anyway. I think he nailed it.
I take natto. I've tried eating that actual, those fermented soybeans. It's very popular in Japan. It's an acquired taste. It really tastes bad. Now, a lot of people like that. We've talked about it a few times. But, I'm not sure what the question is. Do you take it?
How many fibrin units? I can take it. Gosh,
what is it? Is it like 1,200, 800 to 1,600?
That's the thing. Like, we are cautious about natokinase because there's only one study showing plaque reversal, and they use 10,800 fibrin units. The study had limitations. Yeah. So based on the complete set of evidence, there's no other study really mentioning specific doses. Usually the presentation comes in 2,000 fibrin units caps. So if you want to take 1,200, you're going to have to take a lot. I think there's one that has 6,000 units per capsule.
Do I depend on that? Mm-mm.
That's the thing. And we usually go like maybe 6,000, 8,000, depending.
If you're extremely dependent on natto to save you from heart attack risk, that's a problem.
Yep. get vitamin D3 blood work evaluations. Yes, I mean, you have to do it if you really want to know, of course. We usually think that 5,000 units is pretty much safe for most people, actually. We haven't seen problems with that dose, but we still promote testing just to make sure, because you never know. We have had, I think we saw a patient that had levels about somewhere closer to 150 or something like that, and was not supplementing. So you still get some of those cases where people can might have like just inherently high levels of vitamin D3.
And I have seen a couple that were taking 5,000 international units and were getting up over 90, and we did back them off.
Yep.
I've never seen anybody get into trouble with it, though.
Yeah. Low cholesterol equals low testosterone equals low vitamin D. I'm not sure. Have you seen a connection on those?
There's some evidence of a connection. Yep.
Okay.
How strong is it? Again, testosterone is not, testosterone and cholesterol are not the first thing I think about with vitamin D.
Yeah. But, I mean, I agree with low cholesterol and maybe low testosterone. The jump from low testosterone to low vitamin D. Low testosterone, I'm not sure. I'll need to go back to the research to see that. I'm just going to answer this last question. It's not a member. Gilbert, ask Jesus why or how he lost his weight. It's very obvious. Is it very obvious?
He lost his weight and his hair got curly, and some of it started turning white.
Yeah, I'm looking more white than you because of the lighting, which is so odd. You're as white as a ghost in person.
Yeah.
So just real quick, what I did, I stopped being a hypocrite and started doing a real low carb diet, lost a bunch of weight. Then I did a 5-day water fast. Well, 3-4 day water fast and then some sardine fast. And that's what I did. I stopped feeling hungry, which has helped a lot, because now I control what I eat and how much I eat. And now I'm starting to crank up the exercise. That's what I did. I feel great. All right. So I think that's the show for today. Thank you so much. Okay, just one more, because this is important. Did you just say not to take D with vitamin K2? That's what I'm saying. We are the worst communicators possible, right?
Yeah, we should have known that was going to be confusing.
So, but
I think you're looking for views. That's what I think.
Here it goes again. So we are saying most supplements have like 5,000 units of vitamin D3 and maybe 90 micrograms of vitamin K2, which to us, that's a very low dose for vitamin K2. Right. So you're taking the combined pill, you're going to have to take some extra K2. What we're saying is don't take them combined. Correct me if I'm wrong. Our supplement list that you created has a combined vitamin D3 and K2, right? With the accurate dosages.
I'm trying to remember. I don't remember right now.
So, Gilbert, can you put the name of... can you put there the banner to the supplements? We just started launching that. And again, if you don't want to buy from Dr. Brewer's supplement list, that's fine. I can just tell you this is something he personally researched, and it's why we recommend it, because he actually knows and verified the sourcing and everything. This is U.S. made. This is not imported from abroad. And Dr. Brewer's, yeah.
Go ahead.
And I was just going to say, your vitamin D3 supplement is the only one on the market that has the 5,000 units of vitamin D3 and the 400 micrograms of K2.
Yeah.
But if you want to take them separate, that's fine as well. We're just saying if you're going to take K2, you need at least 400 micrograms.
And that's what I'm taking at this point.
Yeah. And it's very safe. I mean, we haven't seen any problems with K2 on those dosages. So that's what we're saying. We're not against supplements, as you can see. But we also said multiple times, this is not going to cure your problem. Everything starts with lifestyle, and supplements are supplemental.
We hope you found today's episode informative and useful. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast to stay updated on all our latest episodes. For more information about becoming a patient or participating in our exclusive events, visit PrevMedHealth.com or call 859-721-1414.